books of sermons. So the more recent one, I think, was a little better edited. But I do want to say that since they were private publications, they were not professionally edited. So I happened to notice in one of the sermons where I referenced Sisera's mother and the 100 calls. Some of you know the Midrash. It came out as C-I-C-E-R-O, Cicero. So throughout that section, and I assume there are others that I haven't seen because I haven't looked at it after it was published, but I'll ask your forgiveness in advance if you happen to get to them. It's just the way it worked out. So in my rabbinate, from the beginning of my rabbinate, Israel has been one of the core principles, promotion of Israel, support for Israel, working with rabbis who also care about Israel, whatever their views of and critiques of Israel, because I have many critiques of Israel. But ultimately, my view is there is a core value, and that is the necessity for a state of Israel, for Jews, and for the world. That's at the base of my core values. That's where I am. Everything else has to be weighed in that backdrop, that Israel is a necessary entity that must continue. And that it is not always right and certainly often errs. And it is painful. And I'll give you some of the quotes that I've used, and I will here. And there are a number of sermons in the book about it, about Israel in the two books. But my congregation knows where I stand on it. And my congregation, by and large, tolerates some of my passion. Some of it they encourage. But I do want to say that I got carried away once. And I want to reference it in the first book. It's toward the end. And it's titled, The Bonds Appeal Everyone Remembers. Starting on page 193. I was really wound up. And I do speak from text, but I do get carried away. And sometimes I leave the text when I get really passionate. So this is the bottom paragraph. The second thing I have to say is we can't just wait for that wonderful occasion when we're going back to Israel, because almost all of us have been there. My congregation, it's a very high percentage. We take a trip every year. This last trip, I had over 100 congregants there. We had 11 B'nai Mitzvah. We do a lot. We send kids. We send over 20 kids, teens, every summer to Israel. So Israel is a very important part of what we do in the congregation. And I inherited some of that from Rabbi Leon Kronisch, Alav HaShalom, who was the founding rabbi of the Rabbinic Cabinet, National Rabbinic Cabinet of Israel Bonds. He was really the premier Israel Bonds rabbi of his generation. And even in the Reform movement, he and David Polish and others were very active as the kind of pro-Zionist movement. When we stood up at the beginning of this sermon, I asked how many of you went to Israel this year? How many have been in the last 5 years? And they all stood up and I said, how many of you have been there once, at least once, and virtually the entire congregation? The last thing I said to get everyone up was, how many of you want to go? And then we all got up. So then I asked him to be seated. So when we stood up at the beginning of the sermon, we saw that very few of us went this past year. It's 2001, Intifada period, early. Chances are, let's tell the truth, very few of us will be going this coming year as well. Let's be honest, I plan, God willing, to be there at least 3 times. I would have everyone in this congregation be there at least once. But the truth is, it probably won't happen. So the second thing I have to tell you is, it's not enough to wait for the request to call your congressman. It's not enough to wait for us to ask you when it's time to move. You've got to do something today, now. That's why there's a bonds card here, there. You're going to buy a bond today. If you didn't buy a bond last year, and you walk out of this room without buying a bond today, don't come back next Yom Kippur. Now, I said I got carried away. But I continued. Don't come back. This is not your congregation. Buy your bond today. If you bought one last year, buy another bond. Joni and I doubled our bond purchase this year. It's not a gift, it's an investment. But for me, it's a bond, it's a connection. Now, that's the bond appeal that everyone remembers. Next year, I gave this. That's the next sermon. What happened was, you want to know what actually happened? About 50 people wrote me. In those days, mostly letters, but a few emails. You're talking about 2001. And they wrote me emails, and they were angry. First of all, the bonds appeal was the highest we've ever had. And there were many people who came up after saying, Rabbi, I want to come back next year, so I bought a bond. They did. And they bought, you know, large numbers. We did really well. The 50 that called me or emailed me or wrote me, I reached out to and I had discussions with. I don't know any of them that left the synagogue. But I know we had some good discussions. And I know it gave me an opportunity to talk to them about my passion and about why. And in the sermon, I'm not sure it got recorded, I actually said, if there's anyone in this congregation that can't afford the $100 minimum bond, I will personally buy it for you. All you have to do is contact me, and I'll buy it for you. I want everyone to buy one. So there was the out about people that couldn't afford it. But they were angry about me saying to them it's not their congregation. And that might have been a step too far. No, I mean, you know, in thinking of it, if I were less irrational at that moment, maybe I would have cut out that line. But I meant what I said, that this congregation supports Israel. This is a moment when you need to step up. And I expect you to step up this way. And I was being in that role as a rabbi at that moment. So the next year, I actually gave what is, it's subtitled, My Response to the Bonds Appeal Everyone Remembers. So you can read it, but basically what I do in it is talk about what it means to me to be a rabbi and what my role is as I understand it. And that times I want to be your comforter and your counselor and your support, but there are times when I also need to make demands in things that I am passionate about. You have a right to say no. You have a right to say, no, I don't feel the same way. But I'm telling you what I believe. When I'm standing on this pulpit, I'm telling you what I believe. And that's what I feel. And I'm hoping that many of you will feel the same and will remain and be active and continue to be here. And the reality is my congregation over many years has gotten used to some of this and expects some of it from me as well. And therefore, you know, they generally accept it. So out of, you know, what it was at the time, maybe 1,000 members, families, you know, 50 responded. There are always people that leave your synagogue and don't tell you why. And there may have been that year. It was not an unusual year of people leaving. But there may have been families that said, that's it. I've had it with Glickstein. I'm not going to listen to another one of these things. And just didn't re-up, you know. I'm sure that can happen. But there are lots of reasons to not join a synagogue. Rabbi Sylvan Schwartzman, Olav HaShalom, we taught a little class that was a supplemental class after in the evening for how to be a practical rabbi, because nothing in rabbinical school told us anything about it. And so he had been a rabbi in a pulpit. So he taught us about, one of the important things he taught us was if you ever build a building, make sure that the urinals in the boys' bathrooms are low enough so the boys can reach them. That was one of the lessons I took away. But he also gave us a budget of how we would budget our money because we'd start earning money, which we weren't as students. And he also said this. He said, if a congregation wants to fire you, they will find a reason. Dirt under the fingernails is enough of a reason for them to fire you. They don't really need a reason. Whatever it is, if they don't want you there, they don't want you there, and they will make it clear. And so the truth is, I believe, you have to be who you are. You can't become what they want you to become, because that's going to change, because they are never the same. They're always rotating theys. There are generations. I've been in this congregation 32 years. I have a very different board today than the board that I came in. The board I started with had a liquor cabinet, and they served liquor and cocktails for the first and cheese for the first part of the meeting. And they kind of schmoozed and didn't do much business. The board today is a real active business board. They do have a dinner, but there are no cocktails or wine that's there. And it's a very different kind of board, much younger, much more professional. That was a business board. Most people own their own businesses when I started. Today, I don't think there's anyone on the board that owns their own business. They're all either working in larger corporations or they are professionals of different kinds. So they will change, and your congregation. My colleague that I've worked with, Bob Davis, for 22 years now, ran a thing in our Haverware, and apparently out of the 1,200 families we presently have, about 1,050 have joined since I became senior rabbi. Well, think about the turnover. You know, we normally have about 80 for various reasons a year, and we bring in maybe 100. Well, over 32 years, you know. So how many remember Rabbi Leon Kronisch or remember the culture that was then? And for how many is the culture that we've created in the last 15 and 20 years what they expect? So when we deal with Israel, it's always, always sensitive. Always. And I have had members who have felt that my positions are sometimes too strong. Though I think I'm basically center, maybe center right. My kids may think I'm a little more center right than I think I am. But I have had people that sometimes went to other congregations that had a different view. And we had that discussion, and that was important to them. Because for them, the core value of Israel was also important, but in a different way than I see it. And it's okay to disagree with Jews. One of the things that Michael and I talk about is that to be a rabbi, you have to love Jews. If you want to be a rabbi and be in this world for your career, you have to love Jews. Because they're hard to love, or they're hard to like sometimes. But you got to want to be there, and that means you got to want to be in that relationship. And that means you want to encounter those that are passionate, even if they differ from you. You know, there's an aspect, as much as I'm struggling with the If Not Now group, as much as I'm struggling with it, as much there is a piece of me that admires some of the passion that I see in their belief in wanting to change the nature of what's going on in Israel. And I struggle with that because they are, many of them, young Jews that have grown up in our synagogues who care deeply. How do I deal with that? How do I deal with it when it's not my own kid, but it is a child of one of my colleagues, and we've talked about it? So I think all of that, what you ask in the Israel, what I ask in Israel, is I ask that we support Israel as a state and as a country, but not as a government. Because I don't support the American government fully in what we do. And I don't do that for Israel, but I love Israel. Israel is, in some ways, my mother, and America, in some ways, is my wife. In some ways. And what I gave you, if you turn to page 16, are just some quotes from this past year or so that resonated with me. I listed, many of you have seen it, this is, because it's because we're in the seven period here, we have the First Zionist Congress, the Balfour Declaration, the UN Partition Plan, and the Six-Day War, all as anniversaries to talk about or to use as ways of talking about Israel. In the idealism of it, in the hopes of it, in what it is in reality, you know, there's a great story of a man who's a psychologist who lives next to a family. He has no children, and he lives next to a family who has three young kids who are always running around, and he's always shushing them. And at one point, he pours a new driveway out of concrete, and they put up, you know, the stuff around. And he comes out, and he's always criticizing the parents of these kids for yelling at the kids. And he said, as a psychologist, I'm going to tell you, yelling is not the best technique. There are better techniques for raising children, and I'm going to show you what these techniques are. So he always knows the right way. Well, he pours the concrete. The kids are out there writing their initials in it, and he comes out screaming at these kids. And the father says, I thought you told us that we're not supposed to scream at our kids. He said, that's in theory, not in the concrete. And the reality is, the reality of Israel is the concrete. It's hard. The reality of life is not simple. The reality of Israel is mixed in its reality of what it does and what it doesn't do. But there is a question of how we present it and how we talk about it from the pulpit, at least for me. That's a very important piece. How I talk about it privately, what groups I support and give money to or are active on, that's one thing. But what I talk about from the pulpit is maintaining that Israel will, in some sense, remain strong enough to deal with a Middle East that is in chaos and a world that still has not fully accepted her. That's how I view her. And that's how I communicate her. I will often talk about the things that I'm working on, that we're working on as a movement or as various groups in order to improve her, in the same way that I work passionately in America to work on the things that need improvement. But I love her no less for her errors or for her mistakes or for her sins. So what I have here, there's this line from Nachman of Bratslav about shalom, which is based on the notion of Esh and Mayim for Shemayim, that it's contradictory forces that you make peace with, that ultimately they have to be reconciled. And that doesn't mean we know how to do that. How do you reconcile water and fire? How do you? I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to reconcile right now Palestinians and Israelis. I don't. I don't know that you do. I don't think you do. I haven't read anything from anybody who really knows. But I do know that that is what we understand shalom is, and I understand it that way. That we need to reconcile it. We need to find a way, even if we don't have an obvious way now. The next piece is from Daniel Gordas about thinking about 10 years down the future. What will we have? What can we predict? And he talks about some of the strengths of Israel that will still exist in all, that will still exist in 10 years, that are still part of the fabric of Israel that we often overlook. The next one down is this homeless ex-con. This actually happened in court in Israel. He hadn't eaten all day and he stole at knife point because he was hungry. The Israeli judge criticized the welfare and parole officers, and he approved a plea bargain because it would allow the man to get three meals a day in jail for a while and get rehabilitated. But then he took out money from his own pocket and gave it to the man because until he went to jail, he wanted to make sure he had food. That happens in Israel all the time. I don't know about you. I've never seen it in our courts. Maybe it happens. But it happens in Israel all the time that people do these little wonderful acts of kindness for others. Jeffrey Goldberg, this was just curiosity. I don't even know if I would ever use it. He had asked Castro in his last interview about the Jewish state, and Castro, here's your Spanish, right? It's the way he quoted it. He said, he says, it's a right to be a Jewish state. He says, sí, sin ninguna duda, without any doubt. For what it's worth, Castro thought there was a reason for a Jewish state. I gave some quotes about Shimon Peres that I think are valuable in the year that he left, he died. I think he was a remarkable individual who had tremendous foresight, who was not the most talented of Ben-Gurion's lieutenants by a long shot, but who constantly found ways to make Israel better. Didn't always do the right thing, didn't always lead in the right way, but you look at his life from his earliest days on and the kind of roles he played in the development of Israel, and not only its defense, which he did a great deal about, but later in the peace process of his attempting to build a greater Middle East that would be kind of a place for Arabs and Jews to flourish together. And he has some wonderful quotes. And the last one up there is about him in his youth, in Ben Shemin, what he envisioned, what he and his compatriots, this is on the back side of it, envisioned. And he says at the end about the founders, the part that did not come true resides in our hearts. We prove that the aggressors do not necessarily emerge as the victors, but we learn that the victors do not necessarily win peace. You know, living with tension, living with the tension of it, of what we want and what we can't get, and appreciating what we have, for me, is part of what I present to the congregation. I want to present to them what we have and honor that and thank God for that, at the same time that I want them to know we have work to do and what that work is. And that is the balance. Yehuda Kurtzer piece, I find there are a number of things that he's really, I find that he's good at. The next piece I included, it's from Batsheva Davis. When that family was slaughtered at knife point in the settlement, Batsheva Davis is the daughter of Rabbi Eddie Davis, who is an Orthodox rabbi in Miami area. She was in a house three houses down from that house, having Shabbos. And she has a very long piece where she talks about how the horror of that night, the screams. And she had invited in the Israeli soldiers that were guarding. They were at her Shabbos table. And they ran out, you know, to go, when they heard the screams, they ran out. But she finished with this kind of sentence, this section. Here he said, among the pain of Batsheva's reflections of the sounds and events that shattered the beauty and calm of Shabbat is the following. At Shabbat lunch the next day, Levi, my four-year-old son, wanted to sing a song. He opened the bencher and pointed to some words and said, Ima, sing this one, pointing randomly at some words. I said, okay, not knowing what I'd start singing and what would come out of my mouth was Kol Ha'olam Kulo Gesher Tzar Me'od. Lavi knows it, and he was excited. Started singing aloud more loudly when we got to the second part of the song. V'ha'ikar lo lefacheg klal. The fear is so strong. It's awful. It can paralyze. But we can't be afraid. Then we can't move. I keep telling myself this. I don't want to be afraid. I want to feel strong and not intimidated or scared, and powerful and warm and loving and fierce. It's a great line. It is. I mean, you know, some of us remember, when Jews did not talk about being proud of being Jewish in America. You know, the fact is, I want to feel proud and I want to feel loving. And those are contradictory in some ways, but I can do both. I can hold them in myself, because human beings can do that. Just like we can hold disappointment and love together. We can hold those things together. The last one on this was one of my members has a son who's a lone soldier, and he was going over to visit the lone soldier, and he told the LL stewardess, asked, why he was going over, and he told him. She immediately gave her address and telephone number, and all the others in the whole area who heard it, there were 10 of them, they all gave their addresses and telephone number and said, give this to your son, and if he needs anything, make sure he calls. They went on a little tiul in Israel before Jonathan went in to the service, to the Air Force, and the guide said, I just built a new house. Here's a key to my house. Any day you're off, you go. I don't whether I'm there or I'm not there. The house is yours. I don't know that that happens very often in other places. But that's what happened for a lone soldier. And I got to tell you about this lone soldier who grew up in our synagogue. Was a very intellectual kid. He's a Karaite. He's become a Karaite. There are 40,000 of them in Israel. They serve in the military, and there's a kashrut for Karaites in the military. I find it fascinating that Israel would make allowances for this subgroup that was a rebellion against rabbinic Judaism and still exists in small numbers, but they make allowances in the military for them. Now, how he became a Karaite is another story. But he found it. He found it intellectually on his own. I have to tell you, I've learned more about the Karaite community because of him than I knew in modern day before that. There's this beautiful story from Baltimore that I got from Mitch Wahlberg about the Exodus ship. I don't know if you've ever heard of the story, but it stopped in port in Baltimore, the Exodus, to get supplies before it moved on. And there's this beautiful story of Passover at the Wahlberg home where the connection is made between the grandchild of the survivor on the Exodus and the guy who loaded fish into the barrels and fed the survivors that were on the Exodus boat. So I quoted a little bit of that there. I thought it was interesting in the polls that Israeli Arabs are more satisfied in many ways with Israel than Israeli Jews. It's the way it tests out. Maybe it's, I don't know why it tests out that way, but you have a few statistics there. I gave you a whole series of things about 67 from Milt Himmelfarb, from David Rubinger, from Yitz Greenberg, Jonathan Sarna. The last bottom piece that goes on to the next page is from Yisrael Hayom. And then there's an Amos Oz piece on the back page. I love the line because it resonates with me. I love Israel even when I cannot stand it. And then he has a whole piece about it. I'm afraid of the government's policy and I'm ashamed of it too, but I am glad to be an Israeli, glad to be a citizen of a country that has 8.5 million prime ministers, 8.5 million prophets, 8.5 million messiahs. It isn't boring here. What I have to say, what I have seen here in my life is far less and far more than what my parents and their parents dreamed of. Far less and far more. And sometimes I find we emphasize as Jews, think of the poll with Jews and Arabs. We're more critical. Israeli Jews are more critical of the state than Israeli Arabs. We often are more critical of Israel than others. I, for the holidays, do not take that position. I balance it the other way. I balance one against the other, but I come out more positive than negative, always. And I do it as part of my, we still have a bonds appeal. It's still a prominent part of what we do, and I want to tell you for our bonds appeal, and we've been doing this for years. I told you we sent over 20 kids to Israel in the summer. All of those kids are invited up before the bonds appeal in front of the congregation to talk about their trip. We spend 20 minutes. Each of them writes basically a couple of paragraphs, and they talk about the highlight of their trip. And these attractive, wonderful young Jews standing in front of the congregation saying, it is the most amazing trip of my life. I fell in love with Israel. You don't have to do a lot more. And it also encourages the congregation to go, to send their kids, and we bring in the younger kids to see them. so that when they see them, they can envision themselves standing up there. Okay, what else? So that was the Amos O's piece. There's another Amos O's at the bottom of the page where he talks in a little different terms. There's this line about BDS. I put it in after the Amos O's piece about the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, something that I hadn't seen until more recently. Some of you may have known this, that was the original plan of the Mufti, was to basically boycott anything from what was the Jewish-Palestinian settlement, and it was the initial approach that was taken up by the BDS movement, and it quoted at UCLA in 2014, Omar Barghouti, who said, Jews are not entitled to any form of self-determination in any part of Palestine, not even the size of a postage stamp. End of discussion. That was a quote from Judah Pearl, wrote a piece about that. That's Daniel Pearl's father, right? Next one, I mean, there are a number of things here. I don't know, we don't really have time to go into them. I like the piece with Levi Eshkol and Golda Meir. You know, they've released now, I don't know if you've read them, but they've released the transcripts from the security meetings after the Six-Day War and during the Six-Day War of the Israeli Security Council that was meeting. They're really fascinating. They had no idea what to do. It's not like they had this planned. They didn't know they were going to win. They thought they were going to lose. They thought there would be tens of thousands dead. They thought they would hang on by their fingernails. And here they won in 6 days, and they didn't even know then there was the Jerusalem issue. Should we go in or shouldn't we go in? They had no maps. The soldiers had no maps to go into Jerusalem because they never planned it. And the Golan was another issue that came late in the war. And all this happened in 6 days, right? It's hard to buy a new pair of pants in 6 days, let alone plan an entire war. And they had to run this war. They had to just do it. They didn't know what to do, and now the transcripts are out there, and you read it, and it's really fascinating, the various views. Because, you know, Menachem Begin was part of it, because it was a national coalition government. So after the war, what do we do now? We got all these Arabs who are not citizens. What do we do? So this was a little discussion with Levi Eshkol and Golda. Before the war, Levi Eshkol said, blood will run like water. That's really what they believed. And then he said, the only thing worse than a great victory is a great defeat. It's also part of it. Then Golda Meir and Eshkol were talking, and Levi Eshkol said, I get it, to Golda. You want the dowry, but you don't want the bride. And Golda responded, my soul yearns for the dowry, but to let someone else take the bride. They really knew nothing about what to do, and they just played it by ear and did the best they could. It's not like they planned to be in control of this territory forever. So I think you know, even though the consequences of the war have been very complicated, I think it's also, for me, it's fascinating to go back and look at what actually happened. I will finish with, I think the last one here is the sermon I gave you. There's some more articles, some more pieces. But I gave you a sermon where I started with two objects. One is, I have, some of you may have seen it, at the turn of the 20th century, end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th, for pilgrims in Palestine, they created a little olive wood book, which had, sometimes it had pictures, not pictures, but etchings or drawings of cities and towns in Jerusalem, in Israel, and it had flower patterns, and it asked you to pick flowers and to put dried flowers of Jerusalem, Tiberias, Tzfat. So it was like a little souvenir book. And these books still exist. I have a copy, and Michael has a copy. If you look on the internet, you can find them from time to time. It's really fascinating. And the flowers are still there, dried, and from all these different journeys, which was fascinating. So, you know, these were made by Jews in order to make a living, because they were there to please Gentiles who were there to tour Palestine, because Protestantism at that time was very kind of promoting the notion of the Holy Land, going and visiting it. There's a great book called Innocents Abroad by Mark Twain, when he went over and he did that tour, and he writes about it. So what was the other object? The other object was dirt from the Mount of Olives. I got on the internet, on eBay, I got something that goes back to the 1930s by the chief rabbinate that is a bag of dirt from the Mount of Olives. And I said, Jews were forced to basically please tourists in order to make a living and to try and eke out enough food to live in that land. And what did Jews in diaspora have? They had dirt with the hope that their bodies someday would find their way to Israel in the days of the Messiah. We have the country of Israel. We have Jews who don't have to serve others. We have a country. Have you been there? Do you go? Do you support it? We are one of the only generations in our entire history that has a sovereign state controlled by Jews for all its defects. So this sermon was built around trying to make that point of where we were and where we are for an appreciation of where we are. So I think if anybody has some comments or questions, I think this, you know, let's do that. I've talked enough. Well, it depends what you're looking at it for Israel. I think Israel does love us. The Israel that I work with loves us. And part of the Israel I work with is the liberal community that's over there. And the liberal community is asking us to help the liberal community to fight the battle. And I support them in fighting those battles. I can't fight it from here. I can support them in fighting it. It's not the government of the United States that's going to change Israel's view on the Kotel. It is the internal politics of Israel that may change that, and I believe we work on that, and that's the positive thing. Get them to support. You know, someone asked me, how are we going to sell bonds this year, considering those issues in the liberal community? And I said, well, why not ask people to buy bonds and donate it to Iraq or donate it to Artsa? They can accept these things as money. Why not? Why not both show your love for the state of Israel and support those organizations that are fighting that battle? And I have to say, there aren't a lot of us fighting, you know, supporting those organizations. They don't have a lot of money. I think there are ways of doing both, and that's one of them. Thank you, though. I think within when I do talk, I will mention as part of it issues like the wall or issues more importantly about who is a Jew, because that's much more. I mean, look, the liberal Jews I know in Israel outside of Jerusalem don't go to the Kotel. They don't go to the Kotel, except for the women of the wall going once a month. They don't go. It's not their place. Their place is Tel Aviv. But the reality is, in Tel Aviv, they got to deal with who is a Jew. My nephew and niece, who are both Israelis, born in Israel, left the country to go to Prague to get married, rather than deal with the Rabbanut. And that bothers me more than the Kotel issue. But I think we can mention both. But it's got to be within the context for me of the love of Israel. Questions, comments? Alternative sermons? Simcha?
I think that this, when you talk about Israel, it's important for us to understand three things that are in the congregation. So that if the Prime Minister of Israel was coming to our congregation, I would have things to say to him. So it's unlikely that he's going to choose to attend our congregation. So I don't have to attack him not there. I have to speak to the people who are actually there and help them understand what Israel means. And I understand it's like the four children of Pesach, the people in the congregation have a variety of attitudes about Israel. And there's an awful lot that a Noyo Daily Shoal, still, a Noyo Daily Shoal, or Tom. I have to fit stuff for the people who are wise, and I have to stuff for the people who don't yet know how to ask.
Right?
And,
by the way,
but I have to speak to the people who are there, and I mean, as Gary is saying, there are many of us who are deeply, you know, for me, Israel's where my granddaughters live, and it's not the
it's not theoretical, right?
It's not theoretical.
It's in the concrete,
my
right?
My daughter and husband bought an apartment on the third floor. What are they doing?
That's
what I want to help them help the members of the congregation understand my emotional commitment. It's not all what you see in the headlines.
Right.
And I think that's what a lot of, some of us are speaking to people more sophisticated, a lot of the people who are not so eye-to-eye sophisticated about Israel, and they need to hear that the...
You know, only one, something had triggered in me. It was a totally different thing, but it about the president of Israel or prime minister of Israel. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, 2 years ago with the Iran, it was 2 years ago when the Iran debate was on and she was promoting the Iran compromise that they were working out, sat in her synagogue and was berated directly by her rabbi for about a half an hour. She's no longer in that synagogue, so he doesn't get to talk to her anymore. She's in another synagogue that if you want to talk to her, she's happy to talk to you, but not from the pulpit directly. I think we should recognize what our role is. And we are not the great Gadolim of the world or the great Chachamim of the world. We have our views. We have some of them are well-informed. Some of them are less well-informed. We have the privilege of being rabbis and standing up in front of Jews who are, by and large, pretty smart in whatever they do, and we get to say what we feel. That's a great privilege. But we should know that our role is to deal with our congregation and to understand and help them to move, if we can, in a direction we would like them to move. But if they don't, to respect them for who they are. Yep.
I have a question about your process. You're right.
Yeah.
My question when I read that is, why not? You had a lot of time to prepare for this. I mean, it's a question, you know, if I wasn't as clear as I would like to be maybe on a Friday night, okay, you know, I have a day. But for Rosh Hashanah, I feel like I ought to be clear. My question, what's the process that you went through? How come the word is
I don't remember the exact example, but I would give this. Remember, 9/11, when it occurred, was very close to the high holidays. And what I had planned for that high holidays, and I assume most of us, went out the window. And we rearranged a whole different thing. And I have to say that what we did was we had three rabbis, and we let each one of them talk about the issues as they saw it at a different service. Sometimes things overwhelm me, and the events of the day do affect me. I want them to affect me, and I want them to know that my congregation, that they affect me, and sometimes it's not formed in my head. I don't write my sermon 6 months out because the world changes too quickly. Now, years ago, I could do that. It didn't change as quickly 40 years ago, at least maybe my perception, but it is now. And I need to know what's happening, and I need to formulate, but I can't always get there. Now, I usually do, but sometimes I don't, and when I don't, I say it.
I'd just like to respond to that, too. Some issues don't have easy answers or there are any answers despite all the time in the world.
Yeah.
And some things are just too complicated for that. I think that humility and that not knowing should be appreciated by our parents, because we don't have to. How do we know some of these issues?
right? Are you? Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
On behalf of all of us, I really want to extend our gratitude and appreciation for the wonderful teachings that Rabbi Glickstein shared with us. And it was indeed enlightening and was an eye-opener. And I'm sure that each and every one of us will be able to use something that we learned here today. So, Rabbi Glickstein, thank you again. And Shana Tova to you, to your family, and to all of your community. And friends, it is a tradition here for all of us in Chicago that we always recognize here one of our peers who has gone above and beyond the call of duty, and we have perpetuated that beautiful heritage that they share with us by presenting to them the Rabbi Mordechai Simon Award. Each year here at the Sermon Seminar, we present that award to a deserving colleague. And many of us remember Rabbi Simon Mordechai as the longtime director of the CBR. When I came to Chicago, at the time he was already recently retired, and he was tremendously warm in welcoming me, and I've seen him doing that for other colleagues as well, and how his menschlichkeit and kindness was something that enlightened us all. We're delighted also that his daughter, Rabbi Ora Simon Schnitzer, is here with us. She's a member of our group, of our board, and we extend to you and to all your family our love and ongoing sweet memories of your beloved father, Alav Shalom. He was the face of the CBR for a long, long time, and again, his sweetness and kindness was well known in the entire community across all religious lines. So, as I was saying, we are tremendously blessed to have in our midst great, great colleagues. And this time, this year, our Chicago Board of Rabbis chose to recognize Rabbi Shoshana Conover. Shoshana, great to have you. Come here with your son. She's an associate member at Temple Shalom of Chicago. Associate Rabbi, as I was saying, yes. Yes. She's an associate member, an associate rabbi again, I go again. Come here. And, you know, I've had the tremendous honor of studying with her and learning from her during the Rabbinic Leadership Initiative number 5 at the Shalom Hartman Institute. And she was a beautiful light of learning and sweetness and kindness and menschlichkeit for all of us. Yes, she has been the associate rabbi at Temple Shalom for a while. She earned her bachelor's degree in English literature and creative writing with honors from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Her love of the Jewish people and Jewish texts, as well as a strong commitment to social justice, led her to rabbinical school. And her responsibilities at Temple Shalom reflect her passions, serving as a pastoral counselor, learning and teaching inspiring and challenging texts, leading dynamic and engaging spiritual experiences, and finding ways to improve our world through the guidelines of our faith. She, as I said, was a senior rabbinic fellow of the Shalom Hartman Institute, and is a leader in the pioneering work of the Central Conference of American Reform Rabbis. She serves on the Executive Committee of the Chicago Board of Rabbis, as well as the Union of Reform Judaism's Commission on Social Action. She's a Vice Chair of Chicago's Jewish Community Religious Relations Council and received Avodas Partner in Tzedek Award. She has been a wonderful voice in our community in 2016. At the JCRC Martin Luther King celebration, Shoshana spoke about Martin Luther King's sermon delivered in February 1968. She used some of his words but transformed what was a powerful and correctly so Christian sermon of King's into a powerful drasha by a rabbi. She is one of our drum majors able to call us out to work for justice. The most recently sanctuary show produced by JUF and the CBR featured both our executive vice president, Michael Balinski, and Shoshana. She was the last voice of the show and concluded that now we are both primed to repent and primed to forgive. If we don't use this time, we lose the time. To our colleague Shoshana, who has used her time so well on behalf of our people and the greater community, we are honored to present you, Shoshana, with the Rabbi Mordechai Simon Award. Let's give her a hand. And indeed, Shoshana, is good to stand here with you and to have your son here with you. Okay, yes, a good child.
Like Rabbi Rini goes and tends to him like a good rabbi does.
Thank you, thank you. So, Shoshana, the award reads as follows. The Rabbi Mordechai Simon Memorial Award presented to you, Rabbi Shoshana Conover, in the spirit of the legacy of Rabbi Mordechai Simon. Rabbi Shoshana Conover has exhibited an ongoing commitment to working on behalf of the Rabbinate and the Jewish Federation of Metropolitan Chicago, contributed greatly to interfaith activities, and has been a model to colleagues for a Rabbinate devoted to Klal Israel. Shammai Omer, Aseh Torat HaKeva, Emor Me'at, Vaseh Arve, Ve'eve Mekabel Et Kol Adam Besever Panim Yafot. It is an honor, a privilege, with great love, and great warmth from all your colleagues here, Shoshana, to extend to you this award.
Thank you. So I'll just quickly say, firstly, thank you. Secondly, I want to say that the comfort that I had coming to Chicago was that I was going to get to work with a great rabbi, Terrence Hackman, be closer to another great classmate, Andy Kuznowski. And I thought that what was going to happen is I was coming here to work at Temple Sholem of Chicago to work with Rabbi Aaron Patakowski. And I was so lucky because I've been able to work with Rabbi Peter Noble, as well as now a great colleague and mentor, Rabbi Goldberg, and photographer Eddie Goldberg. And so I just want to say what a beautiful privilege it's been to work at Temple Sholem of Chicago. But what I didn't realize that I was going to get by coming here and getting to raise children here was that I was going to get this. I have never been in a community with colleagues like this, where I'm constantly inspired. I want to stretch my own rabbinate, seeing how you model yours so beautifully. And so for me, really, it is an honor. I want to say that this summer, as we were studying Ta'anit just a little bit more in depth, and we were looking at that last line from Ta'anit 23a, Chavruta o Nituta, that actually I have a feeling that, well, maybe Honim Agel like went a little far. You know, maybe actually he could have come back to a community where he knew Chavruta so well 70 years later and seen that just because he didn't have his same colleagues, that actually he could see that there was a culture of collegiality, that there was a culture of Chavruta, and seeing that actually he still had a place there. Maybe. But what I hope is that we continue to have this kind of Chavruta, this kind of Chevra, where we study in depth together, where we take our whole souls, our whole beings, learn, and then take that learning out into the community and making Chicago a better place. I'm sorry that I missed Gary Glickstein, an incredible colleague. I know that we all learned so much from him. I have a sick guy, and so I'm already going to say my thank yous to Rabbi David Russo, who's going to be leading our session solo today. And I just also want to say that if you have a chance to study with Rabbi Pupko today, please do so also, because his study on Chana is amazing. Ora, I want to say that this kind of culture of Chavruta is obviously what your father really created and nurtured. And it's been then lovingly taken on by Rabbi Belinsky, who is such a dear and inspiring colleague. So thank you to all of you. Thank you for the kind of rabbis that you are that allow me to then grow into the rabbi that I'm still becoming. Thank you.
Yeah, Alex, come on, take a picture.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you. You're very kind, Michael.
Okay. This is the most exciting part.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll set up lunch.
Friends, lunch is served, and after lunch there will be two sessions.
So right. So if you could do the following, you could grab lunch, and we'll have Rabbi Pupko's session here, and the session led by David Russo will be in the youth lounge, where we normally meet. So grab your lunch, and then we'll start the sessions in 5 minutes. We want to respect everyone's schedule. Thank you. Gary, can we do one picture also?